About the purpose for the station. The reason for being was to promote understanding among peoples of all races and from all countries and all classes, and to provide information about the events of the world that were not reported or not reported completely or in depth by any of the other major news outlets, broadcast or print. And I just thought that was phenomenal, and I've been blessed ever since.
90.7 KPFK, Los Angeles. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Good afternoon, my friends and listeners. Good afternoon, and welcome to the Warriors Guild Show. I'm Jim Lafferty, along with my friend and co-host, Maria Hall. Maria, how are you doing? I know you had to rush to get here today. I warned you about the practice of law, but there you are. What have we got on store for our listeners today, though?
All right. Well, we have another great show. In our first half hour, we'll talk about some of the root causes of the devastating fires and the real-time decisions that are being made right now that will impact generations to come. Our guest is local organizer of the Freedom Socialist Party, Val Carlson. And then in our second half hour, we'll be joined by immigration attorney Rolando Fuentes, who will help us understand this week's executive orders and what we need to know to protect the legal rights and dignity of immigrants in our communities.
Sounds like a good show. It does indeed. I helped prepare it, so maybe I'm being biased, but nevertheless, I do think these are topics we need to be paying attention to, and then some. Well, let me get started, because the top of the hour has to do with those terrible, terrible fires. Another one just broke out. It's already over 5,000 acres. The Hughes Fire, I think they're calling it. The winds are up again, and so we're not out of the woods yet by any means. And, of course, there's been no lack of criticism either of how city and state officials are responding to these record-setting fires in Southern California. The fire chief of the city of L.A., the mayor, the governor of the state, they've all come in for sharp criticism and blame, whether justified or not, whether justified, frankly, or just made to have some political advantage. But what has not come in for any blame or even any consideration, as far as I can see, certainly not in the corporate media, is the role played by our capitalist system under which all government officials, be they city or state, must operate, must govern. And that's why today we've invited as a guest to the Lawyers Guild show a woman who is a socialist, therefore an anti-capitalist, who belongs to a political party that holds our capitalist system to blame for much of what has happened and will no doubt continue to happen as the rebuilding can finally get underway, although goodness knows now when that is likely to be. Our guest is, as Maria indicated, Val Carlson. Ms. Carlson is the organizer of the Freedom Socialist Party here in Los Angeles and a retired attorney who handled civil rights and civil liberties cases. I've known Val for a number of years, and I'm proud to say she's also a member of the National Lawyers Guild. So Val Carlson, a warm, warm welcome to the Lawyers Guild show.
Thank you. Nice to be here with you.
We can hear you loud and clear. That's perfect. Val, the Freedom Socialist Party, in which you're a leader, issued a statement. It pays tribute, of course, to all of those fighting the fires and helping with the cleanups. But then it asks a number of very pertinent questions, I think. And so we're going to put some of those questions to you this afternoon. First, and why did this happen? That is to say, why were the fires so extreme and so damaging? I mean, we know and we keep hearing about how there was a lack of any rain of any much of a measurable account. I think it's 0.29 since May of last year. They had the terrible dry conditions, the unusual and unprecedented almost winds that kept coming and kept coming. And do you believe, therefore, that climate change played a role in the severity of the fires? And if so, do you also contend that our economic system, our capitalist system, is in any way responsible for the degree of climate change we're now experiencing?
Well, thank you. And yes, certainly climate change is involved. High winds, driest winter so far in history in Southern California mm-hmm. are certainly part of the cause. But what are the causes behind that? And that's where we definitely come to climate change. As we've been involved in the last couple of weeks and working with the first responders and lots of rank and file people who are plunging in to deal with this, prisoners drastically underpaid and mistreated, also risking their lives. We find around us people asking these questions all over the place. And we also find people really recognizing the contradictions that capitalism is causing in this. And looking nationally, the efforts to attempt to address climate change are still vastly inadequate. They get bunches of countries together and they water down some things and they come up with some proposals for fixing things by 2050 or whatever, at which time what we're seeing today is going to be much more widespread and so forth. On top of that, the United States is pulling out of even those inadequate international efforts. The science is clear what's causing climate change. It's the fossil fuel industry in particular. It's the war industry. So much of that contributes to the fossil fuel stuff that's getting into the atmosphere. All of this comes together in just an incredible crisis. So climate change, yes, the scientists, people know what to do, but there's no political will to do that. The political will is to give everything back to the richest people on the planet, the very small number of them, as we witnessed with the inauguration and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes, indeed. Sadly so. Sadly so.
Well, Val, do you contend that problems with the water supplies and other resources, along with the government responses to those issues, also made the fires worse? And if so, is that a consequence of having a profit-driven capitalist country?
Yes, and yes to that as well. The priorities for spending everywhere under a capitalist system tend to favor the wealthy, favor the rich, give full bore to the wealthy developers. People building in very unsafe zones just because they have nice views and are pretty and so forth. The resources for just locally in terms of for the firefighting cuts to the last budget certainly shouldn't have happened. Infrastructure wasn't strong enough. Even in the wealthy area of Malibu, there was a reservoir that was empty in terms of being able to get at water. There's a sense of inadequacy in the immediate response. Firefighters were sent home the night that this was breaking out. Fire trucks were not mobilized immediately. It took a long time to get things happening. Compare that to what we saw on TV last night, where they already had helicopters dropping water up in Riverside and actually slowing down a small fire there. It was an hours the next day before we saw much of any water or fire retardant getting dropped. So we really weren't ready because the priority that has been happening around the city of Los Angeles, as we've seen it, is all of the subsidies and benefits and wherewithal are given to the richest developers who are trying to make Los Angeles beautiful for the Olympics and building high-end places to live, practically nothing to house the 70,000 homeless people in Los Angeles County forever. I've been part of an Homelessness Now campaign for the last 6 years, and our message has been take vacant and underused government-owned property, turn it into permanent supportive public housing, get everybody housed and taken care of, have rent control, stop all of this commodification of housing and so forth, and take care of people. We've been saying treat that situation for those 70,000 people like an emergency would happen if we had the earthquake or the fire. Yeah. Here we are with the earthquake and the fire and the emergency, and everybody has come out to help with that. But systemically, unhoused people are still left in the ditch. They weren't warned. They're outside breathing this stuff all the time without masks. Yes, capitalism and its priorities are responsible for all of this.
Well, speaking, yeah, that's a good point about the folks living on the street, the unhoused. How are they getting their information? Are they getting it? And what do? They're out there in that air. They don't have a home to go back into and haven't had long before these fires. The other thing that, I may be reading too much into this. If so, I'm wrong. But I can't help but wonder, when you go to one of the poor and very diverse areas of Altadena, there, the people west of Lake Street there, we now know, were not warned for 10, 12 hours after the fire was starting. There were people who learned about the fire when they saw it in their backyard. They weren't given any warning at all, as were the people, for example, in the Palisades. Now, I'm not saying that was deliberate. I'm not saying it was deliberately callous. But one can't help but wonder why, in the wealthier, better-off areas, things seem to work a lot smoother. As a consequence, most of the deaths were in that area up around Altadena. There's more property damage up there than there was in the richer Palisades. Am I reading too much into that, Val? Am I being unfair to capitalism in this sense? Or was that just one of the quirks?
No, I believe that Lake Avenue was the boundary between where the redlining happened.
Yes.
To the east was a white community, and today the larger percentage of white people live to the east of Lake Street. And to the west was the area that finally, after the civil rights movement had some impact, black families were able to move in and actually build and buy some homes. But the racial differences on one side of that street and the other are still there. And as we well know, the services are always somewhat better, somewhat more vigorous in the wealthier neighborhoods. There's the money there. There's the people with the money interests who lobby the government to favor them. Mm-hmm. And so forth. So, yes, there is clearly discrimination in that, and we're certainly going to see a lot more of it as we try to rebuild. Mm-hmm. We've got insurance companies that are more favorable to the white community, to the wealthier communities, even though most of the time they're trying not to help people but to salvage their profits and cancel mm-hmm. the things and so forth. I may be getting into the next question here, but what the people we've been talking to on the ground and everybody else seeing these contradictions of capitalism start gravitating toward what socialism might be. What would it be like if we had socialism, or the kind of socialist demands were taking place here? And I, ordinary people who are doing this work already know that we know how to do it. We've been in charge of a great deal of the fire relief work and the helping of people. We know what's needed and are putting that knowledge into practice in this gigantic emergency. What if we put utilities, the insurance industry, healthcare, housing, public safety, and much more under our control, under workers' control, make this government own? No profit, no billionaires taking, $500 billion out of what they, their businesses and their gambling on Wall Street and all of that. Put that money back into making safe homes for everybody, having public safety that has people in the community knowing how to take care of each other, and not cops coming in and simply taking kids of color and trying to criminalize them and so forth. There's just so much we could do if we did that. The reason we're having things turn so bad right now is because capitalism is in crisis. And when capitalism is in crisis, the stock market goes up and down a little bit, whatever. But they don't make enough money out of what they produce anymore to have all that wealth. And so they're gambling on things. We have people buying commodities that are fictitious all over Wall Street. And that's a complicated thing to talk about at another time. Certainly all of that is what they're doing. If we took all of that, stopped having wars to fight about who gets to control of the wealth of Ukraine, who gets to have control of all different parts of Africa and so forth, stop genocide in Palestine and Israel and every place. If we took that wealth and ordinary people democratically decided how to do it, what to manage, what to prioritize, and put that to work, we would be able to house everybody. We wouldn't be having this extreme discrimination and difference. We would be able to take care of everybody's education and healthcare and everything else. And, you know, more of those contradictions are going to be exposed as this goes on. And as socialists, we're optimistic that people will come to understand what's really going on. Trump's policies, he claims, are the policies of the right-wing, wealthy people, not him, but those policies are going to make things worse for ordinary people. Right now, the Democrats didn't address that at all in their campaign, and people turned to what they hoped would be a strong man, somebody who could do that better. And it's not going to happen, but it's going to be a while before that plays out. But in the meantime, when things didn't work out in Germany and Italy, it was precisely because the left and the working class and the labor unions didn't unite in fighting the thing. And we're calling for united front efforts to really, really go after after this to, you know, take that. We're not in full-fledged fascism yet, but the threat is real. That takes hold when our civil rights, our civil liberties, all of the wages and benefits and everything that people have to survive, the poverty programs, everything, when those things are absolutely raided by the capitalists to sustain and grow their wealth, the working class and people turn to someone who they think might be able to solve it. But if the left and the labor movement was saying, here's the solution, nationalize this, take the profit out of it, use it to take care of everything ourselves, you know, simply stop working for capitalism, have a worldwide general strike, and let's get down to the business. I've always said that the biggest thing we're going to have to do after the revolution is this giant cleanup project, because the environment is in such danger.
Well, yeah, I'm sorry. Please, Maria, go ahead.
Oh, well, I was going to ask Val about one particular industry that we know has been a problem is the insurance companies. And speaking of the fires, given the cancellation of fire insurance in various areas, I know many who have lost their homes won't be able to afford to rebuild. And this is especially true for the generational wealth where the house was passed from, you know, grandparents to parents to children. What, if anything, should be done to help those who, if they were denied fire insurance, can't afford to rebuild? And in this regard, can you also talk to us about housing as a human right, if that's what you believe?
Well, public money could be spent on housing. There is something called social housing in some other countries. As the capitalist crisis gets worse, it's getting pulled back in some of those countries. But social housing is where stuff is either, housing is either government owned or government subsidized to a degree that people can live in, certainly in the rental properties, simply by paying a percentage, 20-25% of their income. And so if you're very poor, that's what you pay. But the housing is high quality, so people with higher incomes also live there. And the combination creates enough money to repay what it took to create that housing and to manage it and keep it going. You're not sending millions and billions into the pockets of developers and rich landlords and so forth. Individual homes are often owned through this same process. The government funding is there to make it possible. When those homes are sold, you don't have the skyrocketing price of housing. You simply have the ability to get back your total investment and then some, but not a lot. And so the housing, the public funding could take care of that. The countries that after the Russian Revolution attempted to have worker states did tremendous things with housing. There was no homelessness really in the Soviet Union or China in the time when they had taken the profit system out of their economics and had that money going into healthcare and housing and everything else. Yes, there were wealthy people there, and there were problems with those countries that the capitalist system fought them to the point that they weren't able to sustain it. But that doesn't mean socialism, and having us be in charge and set those priorities and put everybody to work getting that done. People wouldn't have to work 12-hour shifts or have three jobs. You could work 8 hours a day or less if everybody was working and get all this done. Socialism offers that promise. And what we as socialists need to do now is say to our community, our country, and the world, is that this is what we need. Let's get together. Let's build the united effort to make that happen. And so we're reaching out. We've had some activists come together, just very preliminary, to talk about how do we get there. It's one thing to describe it and dream about it. It's another thing to actually start putting out that message, start getting a united front together. Now, a united front is a combination of unions, organizations, the left, people who want to fight fascism, who don't want this to keep getting worse. Coming together to decide what it is that we agree on, which is, standing up to that, opposing it, demonstrating against them, getting out our message and demanding the kinds of changes and reforms, such as nationalizing the insurance industry and utilities and everything else, so that the profits aren't in the ether being owned by a small number of people, but are on the ground making people's lives better and trying to stave off the environmental destruction that's coming our way with climate change.
You know, Val, you make a strong case for a society, a social, at the very least, a social democratic society, if not a fully socialist society, and what that would mean for people who find themselves in the situation they find themselves in now, the people that don't have three houses and therefore they not only lost everything in their home and Pacific Palisades, they lost everything, period, in their life. They lost their businesses, too, in many cases. You've made a strong case for what any kind of humane and rational society would do about that. That argument has been made for generations, and it's resonated it sometimes better than others. It didn't resonate for somewhat different reasons during the start of Hitler's reign in Germany, when, as we were talking about earlier before the show today, socialists and the communists couldn't even get together. And so he wins the election and becomes the head of Germany with less than 40% of the vote. Trump this time got not over 50% of the vote, but he got the majority of the, by a small, slim number, the majority of the popular vote actually in the country. So I guess my question to you is, having laid out the case for why is it so hard to sell that? What is it that, I know the capitalist state plays a role in keeping that message down. We're not CNN here. We're not Fox News. We can't reach the kind of audiences that they reach. There are any number of reasons why. What's happened to the trade unions that allows them? What's happened to any kind of halfway counter forces to the worst aspects of capitalism? And how do we bring about that unity that you're talking about is essential if we're finally going to do more than just lay out a good case, but win our case? What are some of the things that must change if that's going to finally happen?
Okay, that's a very good question, and there are certainly answers to it. Capitalism has been very strong in their propaganda. They have a lot of control. They give certain benefits to things like the labor bureaucracy, who then end up favoring them, not carrying over stronger strikes, not getting the general strikes that lead to revolutionary situations. There's a question of leadership within the movements. It's very important to have working class leadership, leadership that understands the lessons of history, understands what socialism is. Karl Marx didn't write about socialism. Karl Marx wrote about capitalism and described what it did and how it operated and why it does all of this to us. So we have a job of educating people to understand that this is why capitalism is doing that to us. And as we learn that, we need to pull together the strongest leadership possible. And that leadership really comes, from our perspective, from the people who are most adversely affected by capitalism, who are face multiple forms of oppression, people of color, LGBTQ plus people, women, immigrants. I think it was Audre Lorde or someone said, I don't live a single issue life. I don't live a single issue form of oppression. And the people who are in that struggle with the most to gain and the least to lose are the ones who can and should be that leadership. Now, it's not a matter that you anoint somebody and say you're a leader. You recognize that leadership is already there. It comes up from the grassroots. It's come up in Los Angeles. Left and worker centers and the people's communities have been the ones that have been doing the most. Lots of people are giving money and cleaning out their closets and going to drop-off centers. But there are people on the ground right now who understand that the most and are involved in that. And a united front does that educating. We need to study how fascism came into power, which capitalist forces favored it and why. The capitalist forces favor it because it allows them to take the wealth back into their own hands away from the working class. German and Italian workers were in terrible shape as fascism ran their countries. We've had some strong unionizing efforts and a lot of happening in the last few years. Some movements are coming back. We're going to face attacks on our civil liberties and our civil rights again. We've already had voter suppression in huge numbers. We've got to fight that stuff, but also by going on the fence, offense, and demanding this is what has to happen, get people feel like they're fighting for what has to happen, not just against Trump, who's kind of a clown and a puppet for the larger powerful forces of fascism.
Yeah, and you make a good point that the experience of people working right now, as so many people are on a volunteer basis as well, the fact that people are working in a kind of united way now to try to help out, and that often happens in this city and in other cities around our country and in other capitalist countries as well. We can take some encouragement in the fact that polls have shown that young people at 19 to 29 favor a socialist system over an capitalist economic system. Even among registered Democrats, for goodness sakes, they will tell you, they don't necessarily vote that way, sadly, but they will tell you that they think a socialist economic system would work better in this country than and then achieve more of what the Democratic Party sometimes says they want than they're able to get under a capitalist system. So all that is encouraging. And there's certainly evidence to suggest that a lot of what people voted for are thinking it was going to misreading what it was going to mean for their lives. When they find out what it does mean for their lives, is going to give us an opening again, hopefully for that kind of common cause, unified movement, fighting against the capitalism that produces the hardships that we experience on the streets of LA and trying to find a place to live and buy food we can afford and all the rest. Well, we are just out of time. We have just a couple of minutes left, Sal. I wonder if you wouldn't just take those couple of minutes to tell us, first of all, if you have any last thoughts on all this, please share your last thoughts with us. And also let people know where they can find the website for the Freedom Socialist Party, why they might want to go and check out what you have to say there, because it's in furtherance of what we're doing here today by educating people on other political systems. So what are your last thoughts, and then how do we follow what your group is doing?
Well, we need to build the kind of organizational means to make this happen. And that starts with on lots of different levels. A revolutionary party is important because that is made up of people who study history, understand what capitalism is and does, and how to fight it, and develop strategies to help make that happen. Now, a revolutionary party is not something that comes down from the top. It's what grows out of the working class itself, from the people who understand this stuff in their bones, from their life experiences. Some of them really engage in the study and the development of the theory and then help spread it to everybody else. So we would invite people to contact the Freedom Socialist Party. We're starting to put people together in what is not yet an organization, but an effort to build a united front. And our contact information for the FSP is websitesocialism.com. Our local email address is lafsp at socialism.com. Our phone number is 323-732-6416. We are having the next meeting of our United Front Building effort on Sunday, February 2nd, 2 p.m. at our headquarters at Solidarity Hall, which is at 2122 West Jefferson Boulevard, here just south of the 10, next to Arlington Avenue. And
the address for the Freedom Socialist Party online?
Socialism.com.
That's how you get to the Freedom Socialist Party. All right. Well, Val Carlson, we thank you so much for your work. I know of your work in Seattle and here in Los Angeles, and it's been something you should be very proud of. And we thank you so much for joining us here on the Lawyers Guild show today and giving us a different perspective on how we ought to view these fires, where they came from, and what we ought to do next if we have a fairer society. So thank you, Val. Now we're going to take a brief station ID, and then we'll be right back with you with some pressing questions having to do with immigration.
Support comes from UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting Jerome Ellis on February 22nd at the Nimoy. The globally acclaimed Grenadian-Jamaican-American artist examines stuttering, justice, blackness, disabled speech, and divinity in this arresting reflection on the human experience. Tickets at cap.ucla.edu.
So, Maria, introduce our last topic of the day, and let's get started with that interview.
All right. Well, let's now turn to the topic of immigration. For the past few months, immigrants and their advocates have been preparing for this week, Trump's inauguration and the flurry of executive orders that have inevitably followed. Today, we'll go over some of these orders and how they might influence U.S. policies and practices going forward. And most importantly, we'll talk about what immigrants in our community should know to make informed decisions based on facts about protecting themselves and their families. Our guest today is immigration attorney Rolando Fuentes. Rolando came to the U.S. from Guatemala as a child, learned English as his second language, and then, on a recommendation from a high school teacher, at the age of 18, got a temporary job working for an immigration lawyer. 20 years later, he was still working for that lawyer, but had completed college, earned a law degree, and passed the California bar exam. And today, Rolando Fuentes runs his own law firm and continues to help people from all over the world with immigration matters. Welcome to the show, Rolando Fuentes.
Thank you very much.
Yes, well, let's jump right in. One of the first executive orders coming out of the White House on Monday concerned the supposed end of birthright citizenship. Can you explain what that is, birthright citizenship, and how the new executive order purports to change it?
Okay, well, basically, it means that any person born in U.S. soil automatically becomes a U.S. citizen. The order changes that and makes it that only citizenship is conferred to children born in the United States whose father or mother is a lawful permanent resident or U.S. citizen. The order means that children of undocumented parents, as well as the children of parents who are in lawful non-immigrant status, such as tourist visas, work visas, or any other type of visas, will not be U.S. citizens and would have to find some other way to become documented. The definition of mother and father is limited to the immediate male-female biological progenitors, which means this is going to have possibly a big impact on children of same-sex couples and children born through artificial reproductive technologies.
So, but if I may, this is something, it's in the Constitution. Well, it's in the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. This isn't somebody's some president's prior executive order that the next president can change on a whim. The Supreme Court has ruled on this in another context a long, long, long time ago. Do you think that the argument that Trump and his attorneys are putting forth as to how the 14th Amendment should be reinterpreted to satisfy his desires is likely to resonate with this obviously rather conservative Supreme Court?
Even if they do, even if they try to, I doubt it, because like you said, it's constitutional. It was written into the Constitution with one amendment, through an amendment. And the only way it can be changed is through another amendment. Mm-hmm. So he can't just proclaim it or do an executive order and get it to change. He needs an amendment. And the amendments are very hard to get it approved. Basically, he would need to amend the the amendment doesn't do by a simple majority and needs to be like the regular laws. Okay. So the Constitution has to be proposed an amendment passed by 2/3 of both houses of Congress and then ratified by 3/4 of the states. And it's only happened about 26 times during the existence of the U.S. So it's very hard for it to happen again.
Already people are suing. They were anticipating. He announced he was going to do this. So there are already lawsuits challenging his ability through this executive order to do what he purports to do. Who is suing? And
well, so far there's
briefly about that.
So far there's about 22 attorney generals from states. There's also the American Civil Liberty Unions. There's about three chapters of them suing, and also a couple of other immigrant rights advocates filed a lawsuit in New Hampshire. So it's already a lot. And I'm assuming other people are going to continue to do it. This is only 2 days after, so I'm sure it's going to increase.
Yes, indeed.
Well, speaking of states versus federal laws, several states, including California, have declared themselves to be quote-unquote sanctuary states. Sorry, and certain cities like Los Angeles have now put into their ordinances sanctuary city status. So can you explain what sanctuary status typically means in this context, and including, you know, how the state law interplays with the federal law and even local law in some instances? Does a sanctuary state and sanctuary city, for example, mean that there's no risk to immigrants there, or what exactly does it mean?
Basically, a sanctuary city or state means they limit the cooperation they have with the federal government authorities. It doesn't prevent the federal employees from actually doing their job, investigating, arresting, detaining, deporting people. It just means that the states do not allow them to use their employees to further their investigations. So, for example, a lot of the times when individuals are detained in prison or jail for any reason, immigration or the federal government puts detainers on them, which means they tell them, hold on, we're going to go pick them up because we're under the suspicion they're undocumented. The sanctuary states usually do not cooperate with them. They just say, you know what, they're going to be here as long as we need them. And when they're gone, they're gone. Other states who cooperate with them, they'll hold them out indefinitely until the federal government gets to them, and then they start the process. So they limit pretty much the information they provide to the federal government, in which the federal government uses, such as place of birth or immigration status or other stuff that sometimes they list. For example, if somebody lists that they were detained with an ID from a consular ID, well, that gives immigration idea that they're not born here. That's their only form of identification. So they automatically put detainers on them. These states or these cities do not provide any of that to the federal government, so they have a harder time detaining these individuals.
Yeah, but I don't know even, Rolando, if you even heard the news today. I saw it this morning in the New York Times, so you may have heard it. But sadly, the Trump administration has now indicated it intends to prosecute anyone from whether you're in a sanctuary city or not, who will not cooperate and who, in fact, they put it more in terms of who, in fact, tries to interfere with the carrying out of the duties of the federal government when it comes to rounding up immigrants. I mean, so it suggests that the sheriffs and others in a sanctuary city who in the past have been able, without exposing themselves to criminal liability, now perhaps cannot do that anymore if the Trump administration has that way. Is that not likely to put a chill on what, in fact, sanctuary cities can do in order to protect their immigrants, sisters, our immigrant sisters and brothers?
It does, but it's hard to imagine that they would enforce it with so many people involved. Mm-hmm. A lot of these laws and rules and stuff going on already have already existed. It's just the federal government doesn't have the capacity to be able to enforce it. So sometimes they'll try to, but they usually don't succeed because they need to work cooperation. Imagine having all these state employees and everybody detained. It would just create havoc.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let me ask the question I meant to ask before that follow-up question. On Monday, again, of this week, the U.S. Customs and Border Protection completely cut off access to the CHP One mobile application. And as a result of that, apparently tens of thousands of refugees, well, really from all over the world, who are stranded in Mexican border cities, you know, to us, were informed that their appointments for February were simply canceled. Can you give us some background on what this app did that's now been canceled? What kinds of appointments were people waiting for? And what are some of the consequences of this abrupt shift in U.S. process?
Sure. Well, CBP One, it was an app that they created for individuals. Well, initially it was used to provide travelers access to something called a 990 form, which shows how long you have authorization to be here in the country. It was also to schedule appointments for perishable cargoes or assist international organizations with helping individuals come through the U.S. via humanitarian need. But it turned into an application that turned into a lottery. So what happens is when people were registered, they would have to physically be in Mexico. They would register for this lottery saying they were coming here to apply for asylum. And instead of going to the border and flooding the borders, they were registering. And if selected, they would come to the border, they would be processed, and they would be allowed in the country and allowed to continue the process of asylum without flooding the borders. There was a total of about 1,450 appointments a day, and they were processed through 8 different border crossing points. And it's estimated that about 1 million people entered this way during the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. But they were granted parole, which means they were allowed to be here and stay here and fight for their asylum or whatever other benefit they could, but it didn't allow them to stay here permanently. It also allowed them to work if they applied for employment authorization, but it was only temporary for 2 years. So now everybody who had an appointment schedule can no longer do this. So now if they want to apply for asylum, they have to flood the borders again, and it's going to create the same backlog they're trying to avoid. Okay, so sadly, the consequences are that these people are going to be out of luck.
Yes.
A lot of people are with the hope that it's going to get restarted. But honestly, there's really no signs of that happening. So if they want to, they can try to stay in Mexico for a while. But I feel that a lot of people are going to get desperate and they're just going to try to cross illegally to at least apply for asylum and be in a safer location than in Mexico, because there's a lot of problems staying in Mexico, especially if you're not a citizen from there either or a resident.
Yes. All right.
And where are people coming from? What are sort of the main countries, the people who use the CBP?
CBP was open for everybody, pretty much. Anybody can do it. The problem was that you had to be in Mexico to register. So Mexico was being flooded with a lot of undocumented individuals, but because that's the only way it would work. There were talks of other people doing remotely through the VPN and other stuff in other countries and doing it. But if you got caught, that was fraud, and then you weren't allowed to use that appointment.
Hmm. Well, speaking of another parole program, on Monday, Trump also signed an executive order decreeing the end, contrary to the United States policies established in his presidential decrees, which included a parole program known as CHNV. Can you explain what CHNV stands for and what was its purpose? And of course, what are some of the consequences of it abruptly ending?
Okay, well, CHNV was a humanitarian parole program allowing certain individuals from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela to apply for entry into the U.S. So it was similar to CBP-1, but they were allowed to do it from their home country. So they would apply there. They needed a sponsor here, either a friend, a relative, or an organization to say, yeah, we'll be responsible for them financially if we need to. And they can come here. It was, again, a lottery. They were registered. They were vetted if selected. And if everything well, then they were allowed to come into the country directly from their home country without having to come through Mexico, Canada, or anywhere else. Okay, this was usually for individuals who couldn't apply for any other type of visa. It was the only way for them to come here and not risk all the danger of crossing from their home countries. They would get paroled again for 2 years, and they can, again, work for, look for any other type of relief, asylum, relative petition. They could have got married. They could have got employment, something else during those 2 years where they can possibly could adjust via that way. Okay, so the reason they got special treatment was because of all the problems they have in their home countries. So these four particular countries were flooding the borders, and the immigration was being overwhelmed at the borders for these particular countries. So they created this program in order to reduce the amount of people that were coming into the country. And according to DHS, it actually helped reduce the numbers of them coming illegally. So the now the problem is of being taken away, then individuals got to come illegally again. So they're going to risk their lives, you know, all these issues and other problems. And the problem at the border is going to continue to increase because there's no way for them to come here again legally.
Mm-hmm. Well, another, and there's so many of them, but another troubling about face, really, that happened this week, of course, was the Trump administration throwing out the longstanding policies of ICE and Customs and Border Patrol, you know, to not arrest migrants in certain sensitive places, to not go into churches and go into schools and in there carry out their police activities. But that, under the Trump administration, has now been abandoned as well. He invites them to do just that. So talk to us about why such a policy had been inactive in the past and what you suspect will be the consequences of it now having been changed and allowing for this arrest even in sensitive places like churches and schools.
Well, this seemed to be a policy more of a social justice issue kind of thing, because they wanted to prevent people from getting access to essential services or activities. You know, so people now are going to be scared to go to the doctors or any type of medical assistance. You know, they're going to have problems taking their kids or be concerned taking their kids to school. Are they going to be arrested there? Are their kids going to be arrested there? All these other things. A lot of people are even going to be scared to go to church now. You know, so because there's going to be a big gathering, there's a lot of people. I mean, the churches can also try to prevent them from coming in, but a lot of these churches have open doors. A lot of these places have open door policies so people can just come in. So there's no real need for immigration to force their way in. So honestly, this is probably going to cause more panic than anything, because, again, they're not going to have the personnel to do it. But if you do it in one location, pretty much anything around there with similar locations are going to run into panic and people are going to be scared of actually being there.
Indeed.
Speaking of panic, I know most immigration advocates are really careful to not spark panic and you know, trying to calm people, because panic can lead to this really bad decisions sometimes, and uninformed decisions. But that said, it is important for all of us to understand the increased risks that immigrants now face, especially those who are undocumented. But people do have still, whether they have papers or not, some legal protections, right? Can you talk to us about that? Some examples, for example, the right to remain silent, the right to a hearing, the constitutional and civil rights. Can you tell us a little bit about the nuances there?
Sure. Well, basically, everybody has the right to remain silent. So you don't need to speak to the immigration officer or answer any questions. You may ask if you are free to leave. If the officer says yes, well, then you leave. If they say no, then you have the right to remain silent. If you are asked where you were born or how you entered the United States, you may refuse to answer or remain silent. If you choose to remain silent, just make sure you communicate and you tell them, I'm going to stay quiet or I'm not going to respond or anything, something like that. You may refuse to show identity documentation to say what country you were from. You just need to make sure that you don't show false documentation or you lie to the individuals, to the claiming like U.S. citizenship or permanent residency, because that can get you into additional issues. Okay, you may refuse a search. If you are stopped for questioning but are not arrested, you do not have to consent to a search of yourself or your belongings, but an officer may pat you down, your clothes, if he or she suspects you have weapons. You have the right to speak to a lawyer. If you are detained or taken into custody, you have the right to immediately contact a lawyer. Even if you don't have a lawyer, you may tell the immigration officers that you want to speak to a lawyer. If you have a lawyer, you have the right to talk to them. If you don't have a lawyer, you can ask the immigration officers to speak to a lawyer, and they even have lists of pro bono lawyers that can help you. You have the right to contact your consulate, which sometimes helps you with attorneys also. And you have the right to refuse any and all paperwork until you have the opportunity to speak to a lawyer about what you're signing. Okay. At home, you do not have to open the door to immigration or let the officers into your home unless they have a valid search warrant signed by a judge. An ICE deportation warrant is not the same as a search warrant. It is only the document they have. They cannot legally come inside unless you verbally agree to let them in. If the officer says they have a search warrant signed by a judge, ask them to slide it under the door or hold it up to a window so you can see it. If the warrant does not have your correct name or address on it and it is not signed by a judge, you don't have to open the door or let them inside. If at any point you decide to speak to the officer, you do not need to open the door to do so. You can speak to them via the door or step outside and close the door and talk to them outside. At work, make sure you don't panic. Do not run away. If you are fighting and you feel like you need to leave, you can calmly walk towards the exit. If you are stopped, you may ask if you are free to leave. If the officer says no, do not try to exit the building. If you are questioned, you may tell them you want to remain silent and just contact an attorney.
And that was wonderful. Thank you for that. And that's something that I know a lot of the groups around town, Chill and others, are already in the process of setting up these educational trainings for people and educational cards that can be given out so people understand what their rights are. It's important to stress, and I'm sure you'd agree with me, that remaining silent really remains silent. I mean, immigration officers are known to say, well, you know, boy, it's really hot here today. What's it like in the country you come from? Oh, well, in El Salvador, it's awful hot this time of year, too. No, that's talking. That's not remaining silent. Remaining silent literally means you don't say anything when in response to a question that you don't have to answer. And that's what's trying to get across, because they will be devious in their ways. Well, and that brings me to our one of our last questions. It is, where can listeners go today, if you know, to learn more about staying informed about changes in the law and in the policy and about staying safe? I know they can come to your law office and we'll let them know how they can do that a little later. But what are some of the organizations providing resources, including legal help?
The ones I trust and usually verify the information before they put it out there are the American Immigration Council, the Center for Immigration Studies, the American Immigration Lawyers Association, the American Civil Liberty Unions, and the National Immigration Project. Those are very good sources, are usually very well researched. So it's something you can trust. All other stuff, sometimes they publish it too early and it's not complete. So I try to stay away from that stuff.
I see. Well, going back to what you just mentioned, just so we don't lose all of it, Can you give us a site, any one of those that you mentioned, or somebody would listening at home now know how to take it down and use it themselves or give it to a friend?
Honestly, you just put those names in Google and this is the first thing that comes up.
And so mention them again.
I would put the one that I trust a lot is the National Immigration Project. You put that Excellent. In and it's going to come out the first one, and they have a lot of research and a lot of information they provide.
Excellent.
And that's a project of the National Lawyers Guild, by the way.
Yeah.
We love our National Immigration Project. They were the ones out there at LAX, you know, at the first Trump administration, so-called Muslim ban that was at LAX. Our National Immigration Project members were out there and helping. So, Rolando Fuentes, thank you so much for being with us. How can listeners find out more about you and your practice?
Well, I can be reached at my office at 818-744-2257, or they can check out my website at fuenteslawoffice.com.
Well, thank you so much for your work. We need this work today more than ever, I'm afraid. Thank you for your work, and thank you as well for joining us and sharing that information that you have with us today here on the Lawyers Guild Show, my friend. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, and that's it until next week, friends. We will be back with you next week. In the meanwhile, you want to try to stay safe. We will be bringing you more programs like the one we had this afternoon so that you can be clear on what your rights are. There are going to be a battle over many issues, not just immigrant rights, although that's going to be central here in LA, I think. And we're going to inform you on how you can protect those rights over and over again on the show. There'll be local groups organizing protests. Sometimes those protests can be very effective in preventing the federal government from implementing what it intended to implement, because it may have to plow through 10,000 or even 5,000 or a couple thousand people in order to do it. I remember one very successful standoff where they were holding immigrants and about to do something with them that shouldn't be done. And I think it was about 500 people gathered at the building, and they decided to call it off. So the power of the people in the street should not be underestimated in this situation either. But until then, on behalf of Maria Hall and myself, co-host here of the Lawyers Guild Show, we thank you for listening this week. We urge you to stay healthy, because we're going to need you in the streets and everywhere else fighting back against the Trump administration. And we urge you to, as the song will tell you, stand up for your rights, my friends. And we'll be back with you again next week to tell you how to do just that.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth.
DJ Namde from Radio Aphrodisia. Join us every Saturday as we nice up your weekend. It's all about music from Africa and the African world. Radio Aphrodisia, 4 to 6 p.m. is Champeta Criolla from the coast of Caribbean, Soca Calypso, Juju Music, Musica Afro-Cubana, Cha-Cha-Cha, Afrobeat Highlife. It's all in the mix. Radio Aphrodisia, Saturdays, 4 to 6 p.m. showtime. Tune in.
Greetings. I'm Chuck Foster. Join me at 2 p.m. Sundays for Reggae Central, playing ska, rock steady, roots, dub, and dancehall. New releases, old favorites, and delightful obscurities right here on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A.
The benefits of donating your used vehicle to KPFK include funding new and existing programming, as well as increasing community awareness. You also benefit by being able to reduce your taxable income. There's no need to deal with the hassles of selling it, and you support public radio in the process. To donate your vehicle, please call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO.
The Bradcast.
Experts have said that the